You know, most of us mere mortals like you and I, or well, most people would say, look at this pain. How am I going to win a boxing match with one arm? It's impossible. It's like, it's basically impossible. And he just kept pushing forward, And it's like I said in the book, like, you know, Stallone couldn't have written a better ending. You know, Danny Williams, you know, basically wins.
Kane with the Peak Performance Podcast, and today our guest is one of the leading professionals in all of peak performance in sports psychology, and he's a number one best-selling author. Dr. Chris Friesen is a licensed psychologist in Ontario, Canada, practicing in the areas of clinical psychology, clinical neuropsychology, forensic correctional psychology, and high achievement sports psychology and performance psychology. Dr. Friesen, his training and experience that crosses a broad spectrum of psychological difficulties, including working with individuals who have anxiety or performance anxiety, depression, personality disorders, brain injuries often occurring from sports concussion to severe traumatic brain injuries happening in military or in combat scenarios, and those involved with the criminal justice system, the offenders of all types. Primarily, though, Dr. Friesen, and the reason why I'm so intrigued and honored to have him as a guest on the show this week, is that he focuses on helping athletes and other individuals who are performing at the highest levels continuously improve and achieve and smash their goals. As we said earlier, he's a number one best-selling author of the High Achievement Handbook series. And in this podcast, we're going to focus on book one of the series. It's called Achieve. Find out who you are, what you really want, and how to make it happen. Dr. Chris Friesen, thanks for being on the Peak Performance Podcast.
Brian, thanks for having me. I'm super pumped to be here.
Yeah, man. Well, you know, your background just, I think, is tremendous in that it has a lot of the hardcore psychological science, but you also have the application and are doing it in the real world. And I think often what you find is you get people who are doing it that are unlicensed and don't have a background in training, or they have all the clinical background and psychological training, but they just can't seem to make the human connection with a high achiever because they haven't been, you know, as I would refer to you as a blue collar psychologist. You mentioned that term earlier when we were off the air, and I thought that was fantastic. Could you talk a little bit about kind of your unique background and experience, both from the training and the academic side, but then also in how you go about applying it, and sometimes I think there's that gap between the science and the application. Could you talk a little bit about your experience in both and kind of closing that gap?
Yeah, definitely. So like you said, I'm a licensed psychologist with various areas of expertise. I've always been really fascinated by high achievement and success since I was a teenager, when I played hockey as a goalie, actually. I went into, you know, my training in psychology in Canada in the clinical psychology, you know, graduate programs. There is no specific sports psychology training. And so all that training was sort of done after the fact. And one of the issues I've always had was, you know, there's some really amazing research coming out from, you know, cognitive neuroscience, sports psychology, just general personality psychology, that often doesn't get percolated down to the everyday person, or even high achieving athletes or other high achievers. And I've always been the type of guy that applies all the stuff I learned to myself. I'm a big self-experimenter. So, you know, I try, I can tell you lots of things. I've tried various, you know, supplements. I've tried, you know, various meditation techniques, and almost everything I talk about, like in the book, for example, I've done it on myself, and I've used it with athletes and other high achievers. So I really felt that, one of the things I noticed with a lot of self-help books is either they're written by academics, PhDs, like myself, although I'm not a researcher per se anymore. And it's full of studies with very little application. Or it's, like you said, it's written by someone, it's like a peak performance sort of self-help book with someone who has zero experience or credentials in that area. So I realized that maybe this is useful to a lot of people. So I really wrote the book. in a way that is ultra user friendly. And it takes sort of complicated scientific ideas or research findings and puts them into, you know, very easy to learn and apply strategies. So that's sort of where I see myself is the type of psychologist that really tries to bring this information to people to help them really achieve the goals that are really important to them.
You know, I love how you mentioned taking everything that you would use with an athlete or with someone who you're working with and doing it on yourself. Something that I also try to any technique or any strategy that I'm going to share with the team or with an athlete, why wouldn't I use that myself if it's something that I think is going to help them to achieve to a higher level? So I really think that that's a lot of a missing link. It's like going to a fat doctor or to a poor financial planner. It just often doesn't add up. You know, you've got to be doing that stuff yourself. And, you know, you sound kind of like Tim Ferriss, the author of The 4-Hour Work Week and The 4-Hour Body, who's kind of that human science experiment. Yeah. And one of the things that you mentioned that I want to kind of dovetail off into was meditation techniques. It's something that I talk often with athletes about. And I think that athletes and coaches have the stigma that you have to shave your head, put on an orange robe, burn some incense, cross your legs, and hike to the top of the Himalayas if you're going to do meditation. What is kind of your experience with meditation and what's the best practice that you've found?
Yeah, that's a great question. The way I describe meditation is it's a form of brain training, especially with my neuroscience and neuropsychology background. I often try and use, connect the two, and I look at the research in those areas. So, for example, the way I describe it to people, and this is how I describe it to myself, and when I use it on myself, this is the strategy I use. So, for example, you know, what you're doing is you're brain training. You're training your ability to stay focused. You're training your brain's ability to not get caught up or hooked by negative thoughts. And the way I say it, there's three reps. Basically, you sit down, of course, and you focus on your breathing. You don't control your breathing. And that's, you know, the first step is just to focus on your breathing. Next rep is basically to be aware of or notice when your mind is no longer focused on your breathing, which is inevitable. It happens to everyone. The goal is not to have a perfectly zen mind where your thoughts never stray. It's just basically never going to happen. It's an impossible goal. The idea is you notice when your thoughts wander away from your breathing, acknowledge what your thoughts are doing. So you say, for example, I'm having the thought that this is boring, or I'm having the feeling, of anxiety because I have to, you know, go buy milk or something like that. And you basically describe what's happening, like what your mind is doing, because what that does is trains you to defuse or not get hooked by your thoughts, because we are not our thoughts, especially our negative thoughts. We want to be able to pick and choose which thoughts we allow to take hold of us. So you basically acknowledge what's going on, because if you don't acknowledge it, if you just try and squash it, research shows, and I tie this back to obsessive compulsive disorder and PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, one of the hallmarks of those disorders is you have thoughts or flashbacks that are very disturbing that you don't want to have. And the natural reaction is to squash those thoughts or pretend you're not having them and do everything in your power to avoid having them. But the problem is, we know the way the brain works, as soon as you try and squash a thought, it continually comes back. And so it'll continually pop back into your mind. So you want to acknowledge it, allow the thoughts to be there. And then the next rep is to turn your attention back to your breathing. And basically, it is hardcore brain training. It's not a relaxation technique. I tell people relaxation may be a side effect, but that's not the point. We're training our brains to be able to basically increase our ability to stay focused and also to not get hooked by negative thoughts. It does a whole bunch of other things. It improves executive functioning and that kind of thing. But that's really the way I describe it to people. And, you know, it's not relaxation. It's not religious. It's basically a form of brain training that takes $0. It takes zero equipment. So that's my take on it.
Would it be possible, I don't know, time-wise, would it be possible for you to take us through like a very short version of a meditation so that our listeners would know exactly, you know, hey, this is an example of a meditation that I learned from Dr. Chris Friesen that I want to share with my team, maybe like a 2 to 3 minute exercise that they might be able to take and use?
Yeah, I mean, I can sort of give you a quick walkthrough.
Perfect.
You know, you want me to do it right now?
That'd be fantastic. Yeah, so if anyone's listening to this podcast while they're driving, skip this section until you or pull yourself over so that you make sure you're doing it safely.
Yeah, and the way I do it is I'm actually usually generally against using any tapes for meditation, because it's like a cheat in a way. It's helping you focus. The idea is when you basically are in a quiet environment where just imagine when you lie down and go to sleep and you're not tired and you realize how much your mind is racing and thinking of random thoughts. That's actually where you want to be. You want to be in a, you don't want to fall asleep. So you don't want to lie down. You don't want a tape telling you to do something. But of course, the first time to learn the strategy you do, or you want to hear me talking now. So what you do is you sit down, you don't slouch back, you don't slouch forward. You sit in an erect position, not so much that it's painful, but enough that it's not going to make you fall asleep. Because remember, this is not a relaxation exercise. It's a brain training exercise. First thing you do now is you basically focus your attention on your breathing. You notice, for example, how the air is a bit warmer when it comes – sorry, a bit cooler when it goes in through your nose and warmer when it comes out. And you're not controlling your breathing. You're simply focusing on your breathing. And inevitably, your mind is going to wander. You're going to have a thought about something. You're going to judge yourself. You're going to think of something in the future. You may worry about something. Even if you have a positive thought, in this exercise, you want to what we call diffuse from those thoughts. And what that really means is notice when your thoughts have wandered and describe what's happening. You say, I'm having the thought that X or Y, or I'm having the feeling that X or Y. That's going to put some space between you and your thoughts. And you want to train this because you do not want to be your thoughts, especially your negative thoughts. So once your thoughts wander, describe what's happening really briefly. Allow them to be there. Don't get upset, because having thoughts is what your brain does. It's programmed to generate thoughts when there's nothing going on. But you're going to notice them, acknowledge them, then very gently return your attention back to your breathing. And you're just going to do this again and again. You're not going to go very long before your thoughts wander, and that's actually good. The trick is to notice when your thoughts wander and acknowledge them and return your attention back. That's all you're trying to do. That's the only goal. A lot of people come to me and say, look, it was so bad, the meditation. My thoughts were all over the place. And I say, listen, that's actually good. It's like working out with a weight pack. The more your thoughts are wandering, the better. You're getting a better brain workout. So that's basically it in a nutshell. It's really a series of steps and just knowing what you're doing. You may feel relaxed at the end. You may not. That's not the goal. There's a lot of other ways you can relax. Take a hot bath. You know, this is not training you to relax. The side effect, though, from this type of training is that you are going to be more relaxed generally, not because of physiological response or training, but because you're no longer getting hooked by negative thoughts and feelings, and you're basically able to stay focused in the present moment, which is the key to the zone. When it comes to playing sports, for example. So this is the other thing I tell everyone, is that you, by doing this, you're training your ability to stay in the present moment, which is where you want to be to perform at your peak. And when you're in the present moment, that is when you're in the zone, and it's going to make it more likely you're going to get in the zone. And you can control now whether you go into the zone a bit better than you did before.
Now, that's one of the most simple and clear definitions I think I've ever heard someone say about meditation, is that step one is you're focusing on your breathing, right? In through your nose, out through your nose. Step two, acknowledge when your mind drifts to anything other than your breath. Step three, bring it back to your breathing. And you're not focusing on, it's not a relaxation exercise. I've never heard it said this way. It's not a relaxation exercise. It's an exercise in developing a present moment focus. And the result of that will be a feeling of relaxation, which is much more closely to that flow state or to the zone where you're in the present moment and you're where your feet are, and that's when you perform your best. That was fantastic. You know, Chris, if we can jump into your book here, you know, one of the things with your subtitles, it says, find out who you are, what you really want, and how to make it happen. So let's get right into it. What are some strategies that you use? And I love how you talk about strategy, because I think you often get two types of people come from two types of the spectrum in the world of peak performance. You get those who talk about like principle and just concept, like be positive. Well, no shit. Okay, well, how do you do that, right? Focus on what you can control. No shit. The sun rises. Great. Well, how do I actually get back to that when the bullets start flying? So I think it's important that people know themselves, but I love that you're going to share with us some strategy that people can use about how to better get to know themselves. So what are some ways that if you would, first, why is it important that people know themselves? And then secondly, how is it that people can, they're listening to this podcast, can better get to know themselves? What's something they can go and do?
Yeah, great question. Great question. Throughout my career, I've seen a lot of people who've gone very far, including in athletics and just in their lives, basically, you know, barking up the wrong tree, I guess maybe is not the right word, but you're basically focusing on the wrong things for them. And this often leads to a lot of psychological problems, some subtle, some, you know, clinical level, a lot of anxiety and depression and dissatisfaction in our today's society. And I think a lot of the overprescription of antidepressants is partially due to the fact that people are not living a life congruent with who they are and what's really important to them. So what I mean by that is at the most basic level, we all differ on five general personality dimensions. I call them the basic personality tendencies. This has been, you know, replicated in scientific research across, it's probably been 70 years now. It hasn't really percolated well into the general public's awareness. But there's, I can go over them, but they're basically five global dimensions. So we all differ. It's our personality. So we all differ on these. They are partially genetic, about 50%. So 50% is due to genes, because we have twin studies where twins have been separated at birth and reared in different countries and different parts of countries and that sort of thing. And this is how we figure these stats out. The other half of our personality is determined by our experiences, particularly experiences earlier on in life. And I don't mean in the first 2 years of life. I mean in the first 20 years of life, because our brains are much more malleable. In other words, something called neuroplasticity is big. Then our brains are still forming and molding. When we get older, it's much more difficult to change things. So long story short, the first dimensions, it's called, I call it in my book, susceptibility to negative emotions and stress. And simply like it sounds, you know, basically some of us are very easily stressed, easily get nervous, may have a lot of pessimistic thoughts. And some of us are more in the middle, and then some of us are the opposite. We don't experience a lot of stress. This is very important to know about yourself, because especially with people trying to achieve big goals, if you're average to high on this, in other words, you do experience a lot of negative emotions and thoughts, you are at risk for failure unless you train yourself and do a number of strategies to make sure you can keep that in check. But it's also, all these things are strengths as well. People who are artists, people who are high performers in sports as well, are often high on this, but they capitalize on this. And I'm sure you've talked a lot about this, you know, by, for example, one simple example is reinterpreting your physiological response to, let's say, right before a big event like anxiety as, you know, I'm pumped, I'm amped, I'm ready, let's rock, as opposed to, oh shit, I'm scared. You know, this means, look, I can feel my legs are feeling wobbly. This means I'm going to totally choke. So that's just a quick example. The next one is extroversion versus introversion. We all know about that. People who are extroverted tend to be obviously like to be around people. This has more to do, though, with our brain's ability to handle external stimulation. Extroverts, for a very simplified way of looking at this, and there's some EEG studies that confirm this, basically their brains are revving a little bit too low. And so they need to get a lot of external stimulation, whether it's social, whether it's being in a high-paced, fast and exciting environment, to feel normal. Versus people who are introverted, their brains are kind of revving too fast, and any too much external stimulation puts them into overload, and they start to feel overwhelmed, and they can burn out easily. This is extremely important in terms of knowing what you can handle in your sports career or in your career in general. You know, you have to match your job to your personality, or you have to work around it. Another one is called agreeableness. This is really our attitudes towards others. People who are really agreeable tend to be very honest, straightforward, very trusting, not very competitive. People who are interpersonally competitive, people are low on this, what we call slightly disagreeable. They're more skeptical. They're less open with others. They are more interpersonally competitive. Extremely important to know this about yourself. The fourth one is openness to experience. This is big when you're working with athletes to know where they stand on this. So people are really open to experience, or just open to different ways of looking at things. They're interested in, you know, and open to different people from different cultures, different values, different ideas. People who are low on this are obviously the opposite. They're really closed to those things. So if you're working with someone who, let's say you, Brian, you're working with someone who's an athlete and you have a new technique, let's say a new meditation technique, and the person's really close to experience, you probably want to emphasize, you know, it being more as a traditional thing. They've been using this for years and years and all the big guys are using this. Whereas someone who is really open to experience will be open to trying almost anything. They'll use like magnets and because they're so open to different things and that sort of thing. So that's really important to know. Last one, the literature calls it conscientiousness. I call it motivation and self-control because I think that describes it better. It's exactly how it sounds. People who are high on this are highly motivated, highly organized, highly achievement-oriented. People who are low on this are the opposite. People, people who are high on this have a gigantic advantage when it comes to success. People who are low have a big disadvantage in multiple areas of life, whether it's income, and research supports this, whether it's income, whether it's health outcomes, whatever it may be. So long story short, the very first step in knowing yourself is knowing your core basic personality. These have neurological correlates in our brains. So these are very difficult to change. So you for the most part, most people need to accept their personality and work with what they got. Of course, next we need to know what's important to us. So I call it knowing your values. If living a life incongruent with your values and also your personality is a recipe for disaster. So you need to know what's really important to you. In the book, I go through different exercises to help you really get in touch with your values. Because living it, like I said, you have to live a life congruent with your values or what's important to you, or you're going to be basically constantly going against your own grain. Knowing your strengths, knowing your interests, knowing your passions is extremely important. And only after you get all this information, then can you really figure out what your mission, I say missions, because I don't think everyone has one single mission, but you have multiple purposes or missions in life. And only by knowing yourself really well can you get to know that part. And then the last sort of two sections of the book is really about now you're ready to set goals. So there's all these earlier steps to know yourself before you should be really setting goals. Because most people and a lot of books go right into goal setting, but without the groundwork, because what will happen is you may be focusing on goals for years, for example, that aren't really right for you. So that's a huge, huge mistake.
That's fantastic in terms of talking about knowing your basic personality tendencies, knowing your core values, knowing your strengths, and then kind of getting clear on your why. Let's talk about that concept of identifying your values. For the person who's listening to this, which I believe most of our listeners are going to be listening to this as they're driving in their car, is there a way that you can ask them a certain couple questions or an exercise that they can do to kind of come up with what their core values are? Or is it ultimately just them kind of sitting down? And, you know, I think often people think that they need to go get away from life for 3 weeks and, you know, climb a mountain or go to a lakeside retreat, and all of a sudden what their core values are and their mission in life is going to hit them, where I'm much more of the school of thought in, like, you decide on what your core values are. You decide on what your mission is or what your missions. I love that the way you said that is that people have more than one mission in life. I think that's genius. Is you decide on what they are and they kind of evolve over time. What's your take on how you go about creating a set of core values and identifying with what your mission is?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, the one of the differences between personality and values is a personality, you don't choose your personality, but you choose your values. But often we're not even aware of where our values came from. So what I usually do, one of the best exercises, it's really existential, is to what I call the funeral exercise. I didn't invent this. I mean, the one I put in the book is more specific to what I think are the best, you know, strategies within that exercise. But it's simply this. You imagine your funeral. You imagine, for example, it's 5 years from today or, you know, whatever time frame you really want. And you imagine your funeral and you imagine the different people that are really important to you in your life, you're getting up there and talking about you. And you want to think of what you want them to say about you, not necessarily what you think they would say about you. Hopefully that makes sense. It's so you want, ideally, what would you like people to say about you? You know, would they say, you know, this guy was a total jerk. He was just focused on himself, you know, that kind of thing. No, you're going to have thoughts of saying, you know, this guy, you know, he really went out of his way to help people. And, you know, his family was super important. You know, he's also about excellence. He was always trying to be as best as he could be so he could, for example, help others be their best. So you want to think ideally, what do you want people to say about you? Of course, when you do this, you want to start the exercise, you know, really using all your senses for imagery to imagine yourself being at the funeral, looking at the people crying. And it can be an emotional situation because you want to really put yourself in that position in your mind. You want to really pretend it's happening. And once you think you should write this out, you know, or at least say it out loud or say it in your head, what do you want, you know, an important coach or important teammate or your husband or wife or your children, what do you want them to say about you? What do you want them to say? And that will tell you what your values are. Are they going to say, this guy worked so hard, he got sick, he spent so much time at the office, it's like he didn't give a shit about the family. Is that what you want people to think? Is that what you really want? And you'll get in touch with what's really important to you. Also, there's another exercise where it's simply in the book is simply a list of values, and readers can download that as well. And it just goes through a bunch of values, and you basically read through them, and you kind of rank order like the top 5 to 10 that are really important to you. And you got to make sure that, and this is the biggest key to success, in my opinion, is that the most successful people don't make their day-to-day, minute-to-minute decisions about what to do with their time or what to, you know, what to buy, what to, you know, who to spend time with. They don't make it based on their immediate moods, their urges, their energy levels, that sort of thing. They make it, these decisions, based on their values and what's really important to them. So if you just take one thing away from this podcast, is that you want to make your day-to-day decisions based on what's important to you. So a simple example is, hey, like for example, personally, I wake up at 6 a.m. to get up and work out before my four-year-old is up. And when that alarm goes off, my immediate moods, energy levels, and everything is telling me, press snooze and just sleep in. But my values, one of my values is to be really healthy and also to have longevity. I want to be there when my daughter gets married. I want to be there when she has kids. Being healthy, it makes me feel good. It builds my self-efficacy, my self-esteem. It maintains it. And so regardless of how I feel, I make the decision based on my values and my bigger goals, not based on how I feel in the moment. So that's just a quick example.
I love that exercise. I remember that's one of the first things that when I went to graduate school at Cal State Fullerton, Dr. Ken Revisa had us do. It comes right out of his book, Heads Up Baseball, where he talks about, imagine you're at a banquet, you know, retiring from your career as a coach. What do you want all the people who are at that banquet to say about you? And then that kind of helps to formulate your vision statement or your core values, I mean, in terms of who you are. And then one of the things you said I love is that the most successful people don't make minute-to-minute decisions based on moods. They make them based on their values. And I know you're a big MMA fan, and as am I. And one of my friends, Vitor Belfort, who is a former UFC world champion, says that the difference between a man and a boy is that a man lives a life based off of principle and a boy lives a life based off of preference. And I thought that was very similar to what you're saying, is that the person who makes minute-to-minute decisions based off of preference of what feels good in the moment, what do I want right now, instead of the person who makes the principle-based decision that says, okay, what do I do right now that aligns with my values and the best vision of who I want to be? I think that's what makes a champion and that's what makes a man. I love how you said that.
Yes, that is amazing. He said it very eloquently. That's exactly right. And this is what champions know. This is what successful people, it doesn't mean how much money you make, just people who are living the right life for them, they're satisfied with their life. This is what they know. Because also, you know, this is another thing that comes up that especially in today's day and age, is that people think that they want to take the easy route. They want to be happy all the time because media feeds this idea that, you know, ideally you're going through life always being happy and doing everything that's pleasurable. But the reality is anything that's important or anything that's big, any goals, it's going to take pain. And you know, I think it's the Buddha or the Dalai Lama, I think, that said this, you know, the difference between pain and suffering. Pain is inevitable. Right? We go through pain. When you're trying to do things that are important, you're going to feel pain. But whether you suffer really depends on whether you're, you know, going through pain to achieve something that's really important to you, that's part of your mission, part of your values, or whether you're going against that. And so, you know, to achieve anything big, there's a lot of pain. Speaking of UFC, you see these training videos, and it's not like they're just sitting around getting massages and drinking beers. You see these guys, you know, sweating their butts off, you know, going through 10 times more intense training than they actually go through in the octagon. They go through, you know, hell on earth. They fight like 20 fresh guys in a row as opposed to one guy for, you know, 15 to 25 minutes. And, you know, it's because you got to go through this pain, and you're not going to be a champion unless you go through this pain and you accept the pain and you say, look, this pain is actually good because it's bringing me closer to something that's really important to me. It's part of my values. It's part of my goals. So it's no longer really suffering. It is painful, but it's not suffering. So I think that's huge.
You know, let's talk about riding the pain train for a minute here. And in one of your first stories in chapter one about taking stock of who you are, you shared a story I had never heard before about Britain's Danny Williams, one of their greatest boxers of all time. And as I read that story, I mean, I've underlined it. I've shared that story multiple times since reading that. I thought it was one of the best stories I've ever come across. Could you talk a little bit about kind of that story of Danny Williams and the just what the toughness that he had to have with that, but understanding how the pain is inevitable if he was going after what he really wanted, he would be able to deal with the suffering.
That's right. Yeah. You know, Danny Williams is an amazing story. You know, he he's fighting a guy, he's boxing a guy named Mark Potter. Mark Potter is actually in MMA now, I believe. And he's a monster. So Danny Williams is in a boxing match, with Mark Potter, and Danny Williams's arm, I believe it's his, right shoulder, basically pops out of the socket, gets dislocated. And, essentially, you know, everyone watching, the announcers, is everyone saying, this is over. Like, why isn't the ref stopping the fight? This is ridiculous. It kept popping in and out. Danny Williams basically had an overarching goal. You know, most of us mere mortals like you and I, or most people would say, look, at this pain, how am I going to win a boxing match with one arm? It's impossible. It's like it's basically impossible. And the pain would be, you know, a lot of times when you got adrenaline, you don't really feel the pain. But of course, there's between rounds, and it wasn't just like a 2-minute thing. It was going on for a long time within the match. You know, this guy obviously had pain, and he just kept pushing forward, And it's like I said in the book, like, you know, Stallone couldn't have written a better ending. You know, Danny Williams, you know, basically wins. He ends up knocking Mark Potter down repeatedly, just because he wouldn't give up. And even Mark Potter is punching his shoulder. You got your listeners, you got to YouTube this. It's real. You can watch it, and it's totally real. It's about heart. It's about knowing what's important. And, you know, he was, you know, I say, is Danny Williams crazy? You know, who would do this? And he's not crazy. He's a guy who had an overarching mission, a purpose, a goal, and he had certain values, and he was going to push through no matter what. And in this circumstance, it paid off. And it's really inspiring, right? You see guys like that, and you're thinking, I want to give up because of X, Y, or Z, you know, and this guy, look at this guy. He was boxing at the top level, and, you know, his arm was out of the socket, his shoulder came out of the socket, and he still won. It's unreal.
And I've used that story multiple times with college football teams already this season, just talking about that it's not what you're going through, it's what you're going to. And you're going to quit if what you're going to isn't big enough for you to withstand anything that you're going to have to go through to get there. And I think that video of Danny Williams, you see it where Potter's just attacking. He's not even trying to hit him in the head. He's just attacking his right shoulder, you know. And then eventually in the last round, I mean, it looks like something right out of Rocky. The guy can barely move his arm, and he ends up knocking out this guy who had been, you know, wearing him out for the entire fight. I mean, it was unbelievable watching that video, and I had no idea that story even existed. I remembered him beating Mike Tyson at one point in his career, but never knew about that fight with Potter that I think is probably one of the most impressive things I've ever seen when it comes down to just toughness and sheer will and not being somebody who's going to quit. You know, I was doing my homework earlier and on the treadmill this morning on a boat somewhere out here in the middle of the Caribbean, listening to one of your podcasts, and you talked about something that I hear a lot of people in the field of sports psychology or peak performance or positive psychology or whatever the hell you want to call it. They will say that you've got to have great belief before you go into a competition, you know, and in your podcast, the episode I listened to earlier, you talked about how that's not necessarily true. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of high-level MMA fighters, George St. Pierre from Canada, And, you know, one of the things that GSP used to say a lot about was that, like, he didn't even really talk about belief. For him, it was about preparation. And when he stepped into the octagon, it was 50-50. There was one guy in him, and one was going to win, and one was going to lose. And if he had done what he needed to do to prepare, then he should be able to go out there and execute and win the fight. But we never even really talked about confidence or belief. It was about how are you going to act, and how are you going to handle the adversity that's going to come your way. Never before the fight do you believe, because frankly, I'm not sure that really even matters. What's your take on all that, Coach?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, you know, a lot of people come to me and say, look, a lot of athletes come to me and say, look, you know, I see this athlete or this person, they don't look like they're nervous. They have like this, looks like they have unwavering belief in themselves. I want to be like that. And I say, listen, they say, I want no anxiety and I want pure confidence. I say, first of all, that's impossible. That's basically impossible, because that's our human brains are wired to feel anxious and to not feel confident all the time. And that's a good thing. So I say, listen, think of it this way. Imagine you had unlimited confidence. The Olympic Games are coming up and it's 4 months out and you're convinced you're the absolute best and you're going to basically slaughter the competition. Let's say I'd work with a lot of wrestlers. So let's say it's wrestling. What do you think that's going to do for your training? You think you're going to get up at 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. and push yourself that extra mile? Or you think you're going to kind of take it back, take it back a notch because you've already got this. So the reality is, obviously we know the answer. The answer is if you're overly confident, you're likely going to underprepare. So that's just a preparation. What happens when you actually get to the competition and you're convinced that you're the best and you're going to destroy this person? What's going to happen? Your arousal level may actually come down too low, because we know the Yerkes-Dodson law, where you have to have moderate level of arousal or activation or anxiety to perform at your best. Can't be too high, can't be too low. So if you go in to a competition convinced that you're going to just basically walk over this person, you're going to kick ass, you're going to probably get your ass kicked. So because you're underestimating your opponent, because your opponent's coming in there to basically, you know, let's say in MMA or wrestling, to basically destroy you. And you need to have that self-doubt, because it's going to prevent you from making mistakes. Of course, you can't go the opposite where you're all self-doubt. You don't think you can do it. I don't deserve to be there. Those are pretty normal thoughts. We have them all the time, but you don't want them to be dominating. So you want what I call a realistic but slightly positive mindset. Realistic in the sense that I can beat this guy. So it's positive in the sense you think you can beat them if you do the right things. If I maintain my game plan, like GSP is saying, you know, if I focus on what I can control, which is, you know, when he goes for a takedown, you know, this is what I'm going to do. And as soon as I see an opening, I'm going to take him down, and et cetera, et cetera. Really focused on the present moment and focusing on what he has to do, as opposed to trying to focus on, I'm just going to shit kick and walk through these people. So you need self-doubt. You need anxiety. You know, thinking that these are bad is the problem, not the anxiety and the self-doubt. You need them to improve. You need them to not underestimate your opponents. And this is big. This is big. It's uncomfortable. But again, remember, like I said, to achieve anything big, you got to feel discomfort. You got to feel discomfort in training. You got to feel discomfort when you're going to go to the Olympics. It's totally normal to feel anxious. It's totally normal to have thoughts that, hey, maybe I don't deserve to be here. But when you do that meditation we talked about earlier, you're training your brain to be able to diffuse or not get hooked by negative thoughts. You say, hey, there goes my brain. It does what it does. It's telling me that, you know, I don't deserve to be here. And so let's motivate myself. I'm going to use that to motivate myself to, I'm going to watch a bit more tape of this next opponent, or I'm going to, you know, train a bit harder, or I'm going to whatever. So hopefully that's my take on it.
I thought that was awesome. Very well said. You know, George used to talk about it being a humble confidence. It's the humility knowing that every day when the alarm goes off, like you say, at 5 o'clock in the morning, that someone's coming to take what's mine and someone's coming to rip my head off. But it's the confidence that when you walk and you step inside of the cage, it's the confidence knowing there's nothing else I could have done to prepare and I'm ready to compete at a high level. Not I'm ready to go in there and destroy this guy, because he would never say that. It's always I'm ready to go in there and compete at a high level and do what I've done in training, and I believe what I've done in training has prepared me for victory.
Yes. And you see guys like this comes up a lot with the Yerkes Dodson law, like Diego Sanchez, you know, you see him getting pumped up before the fight. You say, I think you say yes or something like that. He's got the scowl on his face. And it kind of depends on where you fall in that first personality dimension of negative emotions. You know, GSP, I don't know GSP, but he could be a bit on the higher side. And he knows that about himself, I would assume. And so he knows what he needs to do to keep that in check. But there's other people that are really low on the negative emotions. They don't really get nervous in these big competitions. They get very little anxiety. But we know with the Yerkes Dodson law, you need a moderate level of anxiety. So someone like Diego Sanchez, you know, may need to get slapped in the face a few times before he goes into the octagon to get him say, hopefully Diego's not listening to this. But I feel like with Diego, what's happening, and he's so pumped, he's so pumping himself up, that his activation or anxiety level, arousal level is going too high. And you see in the first round, usually he looks like he's very stiff. He looks very stiff because, as you know, when you're overly activated, your muscles contract. And when your muscles contract, you can't move fluidly. You become stiff. And Joe Rogan talks about it all the time. You know, look, this guy looks like, it's his first UFC fight. You can see he's got a lot of nerves. He's very stiff. His muscles are stiff. So it kind of depends where you land on that, or at least how you react under big stressful situations. You know, it could be that you need a coach to basically start screaming in your face because your arousal level is so low. But that's actually pretty rare. I think most of the time it's the opposite. You don't need a coach screaming in your face, especially if your arousal is already high, because then you're going to go over the edge and you're going to be even more nervous. Your activation will be too high. So it's knowing that sweet spot and knowing what to do. And I see this a lot with high level, like the Olympic coaches and things like that. They treat all the athletes the same sometimes, and they'll start screaming and try and get them pumped up. And if the person's already anxious, you're actually doing them a disservice. They're going to underperform now. They need to be calmed down. But there may be some athletes you work with who are basically not activated enough, and they need that slap in the face. They need that screaming in the face to get themselves to the moderate level of arousal, activation, anxiety to perform at their peak.
I think that's really what the fundamental purpose of a routine is too, right? Is the athlete, and it comes back to your first, part that we talked about knowing yourself and having a routine to help you get into that performance state of, I don't need to be dialed up. I don't need to be calmed down because my routine gets me right where I need to be. And I have the awareness and I have the strategy that if I need to pick myself up, I might do some tuck jumps or some more of like a breath, like I would do if I was getting ready to rip a power clean or slap myself around a little bit. Or even go to the mirror and talk to myself in a certain way to get me a little bit more dialed in, or I use the right music where if I need to calm myself down, I might slide more into a meditation technique. But I think it all comes down to the athlete being able to recognize where they're at and then have the right strategy to either dial themselves up or dial themselves down to be in that optimal performance state. Is that accurate?
That's exactly accurate. That is totally it, because we're all a little bit different. So, we all have brains and the same lobes in our brains, but our personalities are different. Obviously our physiques are different. We have differences, and knowing this about yourself is the key to success in athletics and in life in general.
Love that. In the end of your book, you talk about the story of Viktor Frankl, which I think is maybe the story that can summarize what really mental toughness is the inability to give away that response to no matter what comes your way. Would you talk a little bit about Viktor Frankl and that story that's in the back of your book that I think is so powerful?
Yes. So Viktor Frankl is a neurologist and psychiatrist by training. He's passed away now. He's an older individual. His story is unbelievable. So he was he's Jewish and was living in, I believe, Germany or Austria, I forget, when the Nazis took power. And he's actually he's a big proponent of existential psychotherapy. His is called logotherapy, which means meaning therapy, which is very similar to what I'm talking about, is knowing your why. That's really important. So he basically he had to make a choice. He had an option to leave Austria or Germany to go to, I believe, England to flee the Nazis, because he started to see what was happening with people who were Jewish, people who had disabilities, and people who had various illnesses, that they were obviously exterminating these people. And he basically decided, I'm sure by emotionally he was scared and he wanted to leave. but he wanted to live a principled life, and he wanted to have his life to have some meaning. So he actually stayed. And of course, he went to the concentration camps. He did a number of things before he left because he was working as a physician. He falsified some documents, I believe, to allow certain individuals to basically skip the gas chambers who are disabled, for example, I believe. So he risked his life for this. Of course, he goes to the concentration camps. And I forget the exact number. I know his wife was killed in the concentration camps. Pretty much his whole family were gassed and killed. And he noticed when he was in the concentration camps that people who were there who had an overall like why to live or to survive tended to do better despite being in the same circumstances of being starving, having various diseases, and you know, basically your life being in danger. He had experiments done to him that were just disgusting. One of his books is called Man's Search for Meaning. It describes some of this. It's not an easy read in the sense it's an emotional read, but it's an important read. And so, long story short, he really found that he discovered that people had this meaning or reason to go through the suffering. They tended to survive, and that seemed to predict survival better than other variables. So when he got out, you know, obviously he wanted to see like his family and things like that. Of course, they died, and that put him through obviously a depression when he first got out. But his mission and goal was to write about this and write about the importance of having meaning, having a purpose, having a why in terms of, living a good life and living a life worth living. And so he wrote a number of books and he became very famous. So I'm not saying it as elegantly as I wrote it in the book, but he is very inspirational. He's a very inspirational person, and he really helped us see the importance of knowing your why. And just reading a story, it helps put things into perspective. We think we have problems. Just think about what this guy went through and how he turned out and how he still, I'm sure he felt pain throughout his life with the memories of what happened to his family, but he pushed forward and had a bigger mission to complete. And his work has been applied, and he's done a lot of work. He did a lot of work with people who were suicidal. So people who want to kill themselves, basically people who end up killing themselves often do not have a purpose, do not have a mission. Life seems meaningless. And it's those, if you could help them develop a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, you know, this usually will reverse, you know, any tendencies to want to kill yourself. So he's a really important person in the history of peak performance, and I believe, and just life in general.
Yeah, hands down, one of my favorite books of all time, Man's Search for Meaning. And it was one of the first books that Dr. Ken Revizza had us read in our grad program at Cal State Fullerton. And then, you know, if you ever get a chance, I don't know if you've been down to Washington, D.C. and gone into the Holocaust Museum, but to go through that, that and having read Man's Search for Meaning, it is an emotional experience, you know, when you go through there just to see the hell on earth that those people went through. He was able to then go and write about that and kind of share his story that's impacted so many people in such a positive way is, goes to show that even out of the deepest and darkest, most hellacious times in the history of man, there is still some good that comes out of that, even with his book and the power of, you know, the choosing your response in every situation. It's amazing, amazing what that whole experience was. Unbelievable.
Yes. Yes.
Chris, talking about, you know, you said identifying your mission statement, and we know Frankel had a mission and Danny Williams had a mission. I'd like to know what's your mission, you know, as someone who's leading the field of performance psychology and has the clinical background and the academic background and is now getting after it with, you know, the in the trenches, the blue collar psychologist. I love that term. What is your reason why, or what is your mission?
Yeah, you know, missions, I think, are you know, take development, and I've always been sort of trying to figure out my mission. I do know my mission now, but my mission really is I really want to help as many people as I can. I really want to, like we said earlier, I want to be able to, first of all, because of my background, read the research and really figure out what here is useful for people to use to basically live a better life, to, you know, perform at their peak in sports and in you know, whether they're entrepreneurs or executives, because I work with a lot of those individuals as well. And really, take that research, basically apply it to myself to make sure I can buy into it, because I can read research, but until I try things myself, I have to experience it to really buy into it. And just really translate that to help other people. Because I really think that people are living below their potential. I know it sounds almost cliche, but we are. And I'm a perfect example. When I was a teenager, when I was in school, I was probably one of the bottom 2% or 1% of the students in terms of my academic performance. I was more interested in sports, of course. That was part of the issue. But my self-esteem, or my self-efficacy, or my belief in my academic abilities was really, really low. And, you know, it's kind of a running joke within my family that I went so far and I got my PhD and I did all these things and I got like a award for the highest graduating average, and, you know, how I turned that around and how it seems almost impossible. And even sometimes I think of it myself, I'm like, that does seem impossible when I look back, when I remember what I thought about my capabilities academically. But it was only until I really figured out what was important to me. And I thought, you know, I really love the idea. I love human psychology. I love the idea of that you can take information from people who do research or who are wiser than me, and that could better my life. And I did that, actually. I read when I was, I think, 15 or 16, read Tony Robbins' Awaken the Giant Within and Unlimited Power, and also The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. That was the biggest eye-opener for me. And using that, and I read some autobiographies, and that really changed things around for me. And I discovered a reason. I didn't realize. I just thought I was stupid. And the reality is, I now had a reason to do well in school, because I want to learn this stuff. It's so fascinating. And anyone who's willing to listen, or who is willing to accept my help, or you know, that's just the best thing ever for me. And I can give that to people. And so I've sort of learned that about myself. And that is my mission. It's really to translate really useful information about peak performance, about high achievement, and just about how to live a happy life, and really give it to people in any way I can. And that's what the motivation to, you know, write this book and this series of books is, because I can only affect so many people one-on-one or in small groups. I really feel like I want to get this information out to the masses.
Well, you're doing it, my friend, and I hope that this podcast is able to, you know, expose you more to the people that have been following us here. And, you know, for the people that are listening to this, please go get more of Dr. Chris Friesen at friesenperformance.com. That's F-R-I-E-S-E-N, F-R-I-E-S-E-N, performance.com, and on Twitter at Friesen Perform, F-R-I-E-S-E-N Perform, F-R-I-E-S-E-N Perform. And Chris, is there any way that our listeners can connect with you via maybe an email, or do you have a newsletter on your website or something where they can hear from you on a consistent basis? Because what you're putting out is not only very applicable, it's also all backed with hardcore science. And to find that combination, my friend, is very rare and very valuable. So thank you for making time for our listeners on the Peak Performance Podcast.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me. On my friesenperformance.com, there is there's a sign-up newsletter. Every couple of weeks, I'll send articles that I've written. I've written a couple for Success Magazine, success.com. I've been interviewed for a couple of things like Washington Post about, you know, exercise and personality, that kind of thing, and the various podcasts I've been on, and some of the blogs I've written. So what I do is every couple of weeks I send an email that basically talks about, one of them is about this exact thing, confidence, that we talked about today. One of the success.com articles is about how to write your personal mission statement. So yeah, that's the best way to get on that mailing list. And you'll get access. You also get news in terms of, you know, when the second book, it's not completed yet, the second book in the High Achievement Handbook, when that's going to come out, and that sort of thing. So definitely sign up for the newsletter. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook, for example, but that I mostly repost what I think are really interesting articles about, you know, peak performance and neuroscience, that kind of thing. But to really get the more personal stuff, the stuff that I'm talking about is really my newsletter that you can get on my website. So that's the best way.
And to pick up a copy of book one in the High Achievement Handbook series, Achieve, find out who you are, what you really want, how to make it happen, is the best place for them to go to Amazon and search your name, or go to your website?
You can go either place. It's all sold through Amazon. So on Amazon, there's a paperback. There's the Kindle version, and I relatively recently got the Audible version. I have a really good narrator named Chris A. Bell. I had about 70 people apply to be the narrator to audition for it, and it was a really cool process. And I love Chris A. Bell's voice and style. And you can listen to a quick clip. So that's it's in every format now. You can get it on iTunes as well, of course, but the Audible, audible.com, of course, and Amazon, on my website, I have links to those as well. So that's the place. You just search Achieve and then Friesen, and it should be the first one that pops up on Amazon.
Awesome. Chris, thanks for making the time to sit down and join us on the Peak Performance Podcast, one of my favorite episodes that we've done, man. It was truly an honor to have you, and I can't wait for the book number two to come out, and hopefully we can get a copy and go through and get another episode.
Definitely. I really appreciate you having me on the show. You have an awesome show. And like I was saying earlier, you're definitely kicking a lot of ass. And I'm proud of you, man. This is awesome. You're doing an excellent job. You're really making a difference. So keep it up.
Are you looking for a high energy, competitive way to get your team to compete while training athleticism, hand-eye coordination, and lateral quickness? If so, you got to check out Spikeball. Top high school, college, and professional athletes around the world are using Spikeball as a fun and safe competition to start their training sessions, practices, and workouts. It's also a tremendous way to train your routines and releases and build that elite mindset. As a listener to the Peak Performance Podcast, you can get a free Spikeball set by visiting briankane.com/spikeball. Again, that's briankane.com/spikeball, because if you're not playing Spikeball, you're just playing games. If your body could talk, what would it tell you? Know your body, transform your life. That's the motto of DexaFit, the best in helping you know your numbers. DexaFit shows you exactly how your body composition, cardiovascular fitness, and metabolic health compares to the optimal standard. We know that measurement equals motivation, and DexaFit measures your progress while providing the diet and fitness plan customized for your body. DexaFit is providing a tremendous opportunity for listeners of the Peak Performance Podcast to get their first scan at a discounted rate. Go to briankane.com/DexaFit. That's briankane.com/DexaFit right now to learn more. Thanks for listening to the Peak Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to iTunes and leave a positive review or share a link to this episode on social media using #PeakPod. Mention Brian Kane and one thing you learned in this episode for your chance to win a free ticket to the next Brian Kane Experience live event. Dominate the day.